The Undisclosed Addendum featuring D. Watkins is brought to you by three great sponsors. They include Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, Audible, and Spike TV's airing of Time, the Khalif Browder story. Make sure you listen in for those spots later in the show and support our sponsors because they support us. Until then, enjoy the program.
What's up, listeners? My name's D. Watkins. I'm a Baltimore native, editor-at-large for Salon.com, and host of Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray. Today, I'll be joined by Rabia, Marsha, Amelia, and Justine, and we're going to talk about a number of things. One, mainly, the research process and the creating of the project, why the project was created, and some quantifiable goals that we look to accomplish by completing this podcast. So first, I would like to start with Amelia, since, you know, we're right here, we're in the studio together. Let's get an introduction of the addendum. Let's talk about some of the processes and the research methods and how was this actually started and some of the things you went through in completing the mission.
Yeah, so I think the biggest thing, especially for Justine and I, since we have largely focused on the actual investigatory part of the podcast, from the very beginning, like, I think both of us were fairly familiar with the case, but we really wanted to take a deep look at how the narrative that we were all both kind of familiar with, the one that had been sort of publicized, the one that had been at the trials, how that came to be. And so it really became about, like, going back to the very, very beginning and looking at the timeline of everything, not just the timeline, well, specifically the timeline of what happened to Freddie on April 12th, 2015, but also how the sort of narrative of what happened to him took shape. And that meant going back, you know, to the very beginning, looking at what happened, how, you know, the Baltimore Police Department was talking about what happened, the various witnesses and the accounts they were giving to the media, the various little disclosures that were coming from the police as they investigated, supposedly, and looking to see, like, what information was available when and whether or not it was accurate, and or if there were reasons why that information was sort of being told to the public, like how the sort of story took shape. And so it was like, I know that we spent like a lot of time early on, like reading every single news article and noting all the different dates that certain information was disclosed. Like, when was the first time we learned about the foot chase and the actual running and like the locking eyes, and with Lieutenant Rice, who's one of the officers who was charged in Freddie's death, and seeing how, yeah, the story and the narrative that became, I think when you ask people what happened to Freddie Gray, like how that story became kind of canon.
How many gonna ride for me? How many gonna die for me? How many gonna ride for me? How many gonna die for me?
Let's just, I want to bring the panel in, but let's get a brief overview of what our listeners have to look forward to. Because I know their minds are going to be blown.
Yeah, I hope so. I mean, I feel like I'm so immersed in it that it's hard to, sometimes I feel like, my mind's blown all the time, but it's hard for me to know how people will feel. But I think that, you know, there's a lot about this case that, you know, it happened a year and a half ago, and still, I would say that people don't really know what actually happened to Freddie Gray. Like, the trials are over, and I still feel like so many of the same questions exist. And so our effort has been to look at whether or not the things we've been told are accurate, and then if not, what actually is the truth? And we sort of break down the story itself and then start to reveal the things that we've discovered on our own.
So I want to bring a panel in, and I would like for everyone to go around and talk about how they hear initially, how they hear about the case, and where were they at, and what were you guys doing when you actually heard that this young man was, he died in police custody. I was sitting on the street, and one of my friends was, you know, he was flipping out, and he's one of those guys who is a local rap, and he likes to jump from, you know, one day he's from East Baltimore, one day he's from South Baltimore, one day he's from South, he don't know where he's from. But this particular time, he's a really, really emotional guy, and he was crying, and he was crying, and he couldn't believe that his friend Freddie died. Yeah, he was arrested, like, you know, anyway, this is Baltimore City. So if you're walking up and down the street, you can potentially, in certain neighborhoods, you can get locked up. It's, if you're black, it's not the most difficult thing in the world to do. It's easy. So why was his friend who was, you know, randomly arrested. How'd he die? Mm-hmm. And, you know, and by the time I heard about it, it started to pick up steam in different neighborhoods and people were talking about it. And, you know, before you know it, it went crazy on Instagram and then the whole world knew. Mm-hmm. So it spread really quick. Baltimore was a small city. So when something happens, you know, regardless if we're very vocal about it or not, everybody knows what happened. Like, yeah. People know what happened and people talk. And so that's where I was at. And, you know, so one day I'm hearing about it and, you know, within a few days, I'm getting phone calls from like some of the biggest news agencies in the world asking me to write about it and give commentary.
Yeah. Yeah. Justine, like, how did you first hear about the case?
I think with everybody else, you know, I was in Florida and I just remember being horrified by it. And like everyone else, confused and feeling like I was taken on kind of a roller coaster ride with the storytelling around it in the media. You know, I think it seemed like he was abused before he went in, and then there was everyone sort of settled on the Rough Ride story. And I think I believed that was probably what happened to him too. And I learned about Rough Rides, you know, with everyone else, with all of the other stories happening around the country. This one, I think, God, I mean, they're all horrible. All of the police death in custody. But this one, I think, like, resonated for me. And I don't think I'm alone on a different level, because it seemed there's no good way to be killed by the people that are sworn to protect you. But to be alone in a van and dying, you know, that one stuck with me. And then the mystery of it, you know, when the opportunity came around to investigate this, it was like this one and I think Sandra Bland are the two where it just seemed that there was a lot of information that we could possibly find out if we could just get our hands on it, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think also the way, I know for me, I was blogging at the time. I was running a women's website. And so we covered news issues and stuff. So I was actually writing a little bit about Freddie. I went back and looked at the articles. And I can see that, like, I was totally, like, taking the same information that the rest of the media was doing and sort of running with it. And it's been interesting now to, like, go back and read those pieces and being like, oh, God, if only I had known then what I know now, like, that this actual little narrative is not quite accurate. But that's how that story got disseminated, you know? Bloggers like me writing about it.
No, most of these cases are like, you know, because again, it goes back to that rush to, you know, who can get the story first and who can get the information out the quickest. So a lot of these things aren't really being vetted properly or paid the attention that they deserve.
Yeah. And there was, like, in this case, I think that they were really, there was a sort of like illusion of transparency to a degree where the police were like holding their press conferences and releasing timelines. And it, I think, gave the appearance that they were really trying to figure out what happened. Whether or not that's the case is what we'll be sort of talking about on the podcast.
And what about you, Marcia?
Well, for me, you know, this story kind of fit within a landscape of my growing awareness, not of police brutality, because I knew that, I've known that's been a fact of history, but the various ways that one moment was going to inform another. And so I spent a lot of time on social media encouraging educators to talk to their students about the crisis in Ferguson. And in doing that kind of work, it's kind of interesting how in August 2014, there was a sense that, okay, we have found ourselves at another tipping point in America's history of racial terrorism, and maybe something different can come out of it if we're, you know, more productive. And I think the conversation about police accountability and body cameras and protocol, you know, I think that people were generating a hope that this time there could actually be some responsibility and accountability. And then when the acquittal happened in the killing of Michael Brown, I think people returned to this kind of question of how do we respond? And so by the time that April 2015 had come about, I think that the conversations that I was having with people was about an exasperation that there had been so much energy and creativity that had come out of Ferguson and I think continues today. But the fact that without any type of mechanism of really changing the nature of how these cases are investigated, how they're framed to the public, this idea of accountability on many levels, you come back to the same place. So the Freddie Gray story was a story that immediately I was following and I was talking to people, I was talking to my students about, I was reaching out to other scholars who were thinking about ways to talk about this in their classrooms. And so I think that what we've seen in this country over the past 3 years isn't more cases of police brutality necessarily. I think there's just a heightened consciousness, and the quality of the conversation around it, I think, has improved. But the question is, how do we translate that into actual actions that can put an end to it?
So as far as like the people you reached out to, has any showed any faith in the system? Have you worked with groups that actually have faith in the system, or that has had faith before what happened over the last 3 years?
Well, I think that's a great question. So it's mixed, right? So on one hand, I would say that what happened with the Ferguson uprising and afterward is that people just became better informed citizens broadly, so that people took the anecdotal experiences of police conflict and brutality, and some people were able to plug in a larger lens, right? That it isn't just this community or isn't just this set of practices, but actually a lot of this stuff is protected by the Supreme Court, and a lot of it's going to be protected by the county prosecutors, and it's going to be, you know, protected at the very highest levels, right? So on one hand, I think there's a growing consciousness of why this isn't a matter of individuals just doing the right thing, because I think sometimes in these conversations, we focus on individual choices. Well, if a person had done X, then Y wouldn't happen. And when you're talking about a structure, you can say, wait a second, this is all being shaped by these forces that are outside of the hands of people, and unfortunately outside of the hands of community. So I think that for the educators I talk to and they work with, they understand the value of creating the space and bringing in the content in the classroom so that their students can have an analysis that's well-informed and resist some of this really easy way that these issues are covered. And at the same time, you know, knowledge isn't always the pathway to optimism, and sometimes that's the only way you get free. So it's like such a mixed bag that on one hand, I'm so glad that so many people are invested in learning more about how the system fails them, but we have to have a mechanism in which to actually do something about it, and that's where I think it becomes a real mixed bag.
And what about your experience, Rabia?
Well, I mean, look, I have come to this story really in some ways, and I feel ashamed saying this, as an outsider watching and learning about the experience of Black America and policing. And when Freddie Gray was injured, you know, I learned it like many other people did with the videos that were being circulated. I'm pretty sure that either I saw it on social media or somebody, like, you know, tweeted at me or sent it to me in a message that, you know, watch this video. And that video, I remember seeing over and over again and just kind of shocked, because his cries were so haunting and there were people watching this. So many people were witnessing what had happened to him, and that it was so clear that he was so in so much pain. And then his death that came so shortly afterwards. And this all happened in kind of the wake of the Serial podcast, which brought Adnan's case to light, and my own awareness in those years of how actors in a system work to protect one another, and there is literally no accountability. So in this situation, I already knew that, okay, they're calling for an investigation. The police are going to investigate themselves. The state's attorney is going to try to prosecute these cops. I have had very low faith, not just in any accountability that's coming from within a system, because over and over, we just don't see it. It doesn't happen. And then on top of that, I have been very skeptical of how media covers a crime, because with Adnan's case and many other cases, what you see is you see a very shallow level of reporting. It's not journalism. It's not investigation. It's just reporting and parroting back what they're being told. So, you know, what's been amazing for me, and, you know, I would say Justine and Amelia are really the investigators on this series. And I learned this with Adnan's case. I've learned this with our last case that we just did on Undisclosed last year, Joey Watkins, is the value of piecing together timelines. When information comes out, when we know the police have information, when a witness says something, and putting that all together, because it gives you a very different understanding of what actually happened and maybe why it happened. And I think one of the most revealing things in this series is going to be showing how Justine and Amelia were able to piece together the timeline in a way that no media outlet, nobody covered. And it just tells a different story.
Yeah. I mean, the thing in this case is, like, when you really start looking at when certain information came out, like at what point a certain bit of information, a certain fact, a whatever, became part of the narrative. And you go back to that moment and you see when it happened and who was saying it and who was telling the world about it. And it gives you a better picture of its accuracy in a weird way. You get to see it in the context of everything else and saying, oh, so did they say that then because they wanted to cover up for what was sort of starting to get buzz? Like, you know, early on the first week, I mean, Robbie mentioned it, you know, Kevin Moore's video, he was one of the people who had filmed the Freddie at the arrest point on Presbury Street. You know, I fully believe, like, if he had not uploaded that video the next day, you know, he had given it to the police first. Like, he did what he was supposed to do. He went directly to Baltimore's. He went to the Western District Station and he handed over his phone. Mm-hmm. And then he uploaded the video the next day. And I feel like if he hadn't uploaded it, I doubt, I mean, you
we
know.
We never would have saw that video.
No, we would never would have seen the video. And, you know, while I'm sure there was something would have been done as far as Freddie's injury, because I'm sure something would have come of it, but not to the degree that it did. And that's why, you know, organizations like Cop Watch, like, there's real value there, because it's one of the ways that people can sort of try and have some influence on holding people accountable.
On Wednesday, March 15th at 10 p.m. on Spike, from executive producers Sean, J.C. Carter, and Harvey Weinstein, the groundbreaking six-part documentary event series continues. Time, the Kalief Browder story. Browder was a 16-year-old African-American high school student from the Bronx walking home from a party when he was arrested for allegedly stealing a backpack. He then spent an unthinkable 3 years on Rikers Island without ever being convicted of a crime. The series uses first-person accounts, unprecedented archival footage, and interviews with politicians, friends, and family to take a comprehensive look at how Kalief's light shines a light on the inequalities inside the criminal justice system. Jay-Z has said that Kalief Browder is a modern-day prophet. Variety calls Time an important contribution to the true crime documentary genre. The Daily Beast says it's the best documentary coming out of Sundance and may be this year's OJ Made in America. Revolt TV has called it captivating. Time, the Kalief Browder story continues Wednesday, March 15th at 10 p.m. on Spike.
I want to direct this question to the panel. What is the biggest misconception about this case?
You know, I'll take a stab at that if it's okay. It's a little hard to answer that because we have so much information that hasn't been shared and still questions. But probably the biggest misconception is that, well, I would say that there's two. And I don't want to give away too much, but I would say the first misconception that comes to mind is that the state's attorney's office vigorously prosecuted these officers. It looks like it. They filed a lot of charges, including a murder charge. But when we talk about systems of accountability, we talk about, you know, internally the investigatory process. We, you know, that goes down to like, who's somebody's supervisor? Are they holding people accountable? Are cops holding each other accountable? Is the media holding people accountable? And here it looked like the state's attorney held these officers accountable. And so we're going to raise a lot of questions around that. I don't think it's that simple. And I guess another misconception, although we can't say for sure yet, but, you know, there's a lot of misconceptions around how Freddie Gray was killed. So I'll just leave it at that.
Yeah. No, yeah, we can't give it away too early.
Yeah. There's so many stories out there. He banged his head against the, well, there was a rough ride, and there's just not a lot of proof for most of the stories around how Freddie Gray was killed.
Yeah. One thing I hope we get a chance to work towards is there's a common belief in this country, and I've actually sat in the same room with then President Obama when he said it, but his words were, it's impossible to charge and convict a police officer in this country. I think that's a major problem, but I would like to get some feedback from you guys.
I mean, I think the fundamental problem in the way that we think about policing in general is that in moments like this, when communities are asking for accountability, when we see a state's attorney's office seem to kind of pursue, I think sometimes we lose sight of just how powerful not only police unions are, but a general public belief that no one does anything unless they absolutely had to, or that these acts of violence are, if not invited, but justified. And so I think that what we're seeing now is we see some really organized and thoughtful movements that are looking for accountability, but they capture such a small number of the population. And so what we see in this current administration with the Attorney General and the President of the United States, they're riling up people to believe that law enforcement is under attack when they're simply being critiqued. And I think that that's a really important distinction we have to make of how difficult it is to create public policy in a climate in which the number of people who are actually critical of police is still very small across, you know, racial and ethnic lines. Most people are not anti-police in the United States. But what we hear is the rhetoric that police officers are so disrespected, they're under scrutiny, they're under siege in a systematic and organized way. And then it creates a climate in which the public starts to support these mechanisms for no accountability, right? So it isn't so much about what has happened, but rather the climate in which it happens and how the rhetoric of anti-policing is so powerful, even when, you know, it's confronted with so much evidence that there are real structural, systemic, and individual problems.
We all know until police officers are held accountable, reform won't exist.
Absolutely.
What's the consequence?
Yeah, well, like, what's the problem, right? And then I think the thing that's also really hard is that we start to believe that technology will free us from this, right? So, you know, the movement for body cameras, the movement for dashboard cameras, I understand the impulse that animates that kind of, you know, solution creation. But we see that just because we have access to video or just because we have these mechanisms, they don't just exist by themselves, right? They all have to be put within a system. And so I think that this is why this podcast and other projects like it have an educational value, because it isn't just recounting the details of a particular incident. It's putting it within a framework so that we can better understand why this work is not only so challenging, but so important.
I'm from the Annie Jones era, when homicides was high. Every night you hear a group of bullets flying through the sky. West, I be getting money, but it's different on my side. Lord, 14 already
trying to ride. Even when they go, I was going to play devil's advocate for a second, because the question was about, you know, how can police be held accountable and how can they be charged? And a lot of the work that I've been doing over the last few months has been to spend a lot of time talking to police officers, which is intimidating, enlightening, great. And sad, because I realized what huge walls there are between Black and Blue lives and what misunderstanding there is and sort of blind spots and yet good people. But in terms of police getting charged, you know, it's interesting if you look back even under Commissioner Batts before Freddie Gray and Mosby, or before Mosby, the state's attorney Bernstein, officers were getting charged for crimes for their performance on duty. There was an officer who beat up someone at a bus stop and someone who slit a dog's throat. What I'm finding, and actually it happens a lot, where cops are charged and we don't necessarily hear about it. What I'm finding is political calculations around who gets charged and who doesn't that I think might be not helpful. It might not be necessarily always grounded exactly in the same truth case by case. And, you know, decisions being made about who can we charge in this particular case and who won't we charge based on optics, as opposed to just, you know, somebody behaved incorrectly.
Well, Justine, I have a question for you then, just to follow that up. Is part of that calculation who is the victim? I feel like Americans are much more outraged at animal cruelty than they are at the bodies of people of color being hurt. So I'm wondering, is that also, you think, part of the calculation? Is who to charge and when to charge? Do you think it depends on maybe even who the victim is of that officer's misconduct?
Yeah, I would say it's a big set of things, including who is the victim? What is that officer's standing in the police community? How much of this has been seen, you know, can be covered up or not covered up. So definitely that's part of the calculation.
But I think it returns to my earlier point, because yes, you can have charges, but if it has to go to grand juries, which are made up of citizens, and if it goes to juries, if they go to trial, they're everyday citizens. And I think these are not people who are necessarily critical of policing or who can be apologists for certain behaviors. And I think that there's also a mechanism of popular culture that normalizes a form of police violence. And so in many ways, we see the problem with the accountability mechanism also depending on a public that might have a relationship to policing that doesn't necessarily mirror that of the victim.
Audible is a leading provider of premium digital spoken audio information and entertainment on the internet. Audible content includes an unmatched selection of audiobooks, original audio shows, news, comedy, and more. Most recently, I used Audible to listen to All the Birds in the Sky by Charlie Jane Anders, a genre-bending sci-fi novel about a witch and her friend who's invented a time machine that allows them to travel 2 seconds into the future. If you like my blending of pop culture and social commentary on Undisclosed, then you might really enjoy this story by the editor-in-chief of IO9. And now, Audible is offering our listeners a free audiobook with a 30-day trial membership. Just go to audible.com/undisclosed and browse the unmatched selection of audio programs. Download a title free of charge and start listening. It's that easy. Go to audible.com/undisclosed. That's audible.com/undisclosed and get started today.
One of the biggest learning experiences for me doing this, I've been spending, you know, time in Baltimore and going to the community where Freddie lived and just talking to witnesses, but just talking to people who live there. And, you know, I didn't grow up like wealthy or anything like that, but I never had any negative experiences as a kid or a teenager with police officers. My father had been in prison and he had negative experiences. So I didn't grow up sort of believing that cops are like heroes all the time.
Interesting. I never had a positive.
Yeah, well, that's the point, though. That's what I was going to say.
I think I had like one. I played basketball in a PAL league and, you know, the cops were nice. And then, you know, like we grew up and they weren't nice anymore.
Well, that's the thing. That's what I think is so interesting and, you know, has been heartbreaking sort of talking to people is that my just sort of life experience, even being a person who sort of questions how much authority we give to the police, but I've never had a personal experience where I've never been abused by a police officer. I've never been arrested for no damn reason. I've never had anything like that. But I think that one of the things that's been interesting is talking to people. And in Freddie's neighborhood, though, is they've had such a starkly different experience with the police their entire lives growing up in Sandtown. And, you know, for people who aren't from communities like that, who have negative experiences with the police as like a regular part of their lives, people can't conceptualize that what people who in Freddie's neighborhood have experienced, that's reality for them. And that it's so important to just listen to people and to give people the space to tell their stories and to believe them because we expect the same thing for ourselves. And, you know, I feel this was a real sort of case where those people were given a few days to say what they thought happened and then they were ignored because people just don't quite believe it. It's like they don't believe what, you know, those witnesses saw happened. And it makes no sense to me because it's just as valid a perspective to be considered as any other.
Well, you know, this is to me the power of narrative over fact. And we see this over and over again. And when it comes to police, I feel like there's a real strong tie between the way it's almost like a test of patriotism, the way we are supposed to respond to, like, say, the military and the police. It's almost like this unconditional support, uncritical support. And if you question it, it's almost reflects on, like, you know, how American are you? And for me growing up, now my experience, you know, I'm an immigrant to this country. I came here as an infant, has really been a real distance from the police. Like we had almost no it didn't mean we didn't worry about the police because we come from countries, my family, many immigrants come from countries where the police are just, there's no trust in the police and the judiciary. But we just kept a distance. But at the same time, I grew up watching like Barney Fife and all these really positive portrayals of police being the white hats. And in this country, yeah, law and order. And like, you know, the police like and wanting to get it right. And I do believe that the police are human beings. There are people who want to get it right and do the best they can. And there are a couple of bad apples who can like rock that boat. But one of the most frustrating things, like, you know, Marsha said, in the face of evidence, facts, documentation, video, you still cannot get people to move their sentiments on these issues.
I think it's also part of the fact that there's the narrative that police are heroes. And that's so ingrained in our belief system.
It's a tradition, right?
Yeah. I mean, it's all of our media. It's in all of our entertainment. Even, you know, when you have a movie that's about bad cops, it's like they're the outlier, you know, and they're always so extreme too. So the consistent problems with policing are not sort of shown to people at all, but they're a reality for so many people.
This is why exposure to just different experiences have always blown my mind, because again, to this day, I still don't understand how you can, you know, apply for a job and go through academy, and the second you walk out of academy, you're instantly a hero.
Yeah.
The recipe is so easy.
Like, yeah.
It's the easiest way to, but the only quicker way you can probably become a hero is if you like join the service or something, because these people don't join these organizations for the benefits. They don't join them for salaries. They don't join them for the discount you get on college and housing. They join them to become heroes, right?
Yeah, it's true. I mean, like, when you look at the pay scale of
I was being sarcastic.
But no, like, they don't get, like, you know, being a cop is like not a ticket to tremendous wealth by any means. But
in comparison to what, though?
Well, that's true.
Unemployment, like,
I guess it depends.
But I also think that, like, we can never underscore how seductive access to power is, even if the power is constrained, even if the power is problematic, even if the power puts you at risk. And so I think that what's amazing about the discourses about policing is that the quality of the job, right? There's a lot of questions about that. But I think the fact that it's not just prestige, but it's an incredible amount of power, and sometimes in the most vulnerable communities. The other day in class, I was showing students a documentary about the 1980 killing of a motorcycle rider, Arthur McDuffie, in Miami. And one of the people in the documentary says, "We knew that it was practice in Miami that the police officers, as punishment, were sent into black communities to do policing. We knew that this was a punitive measure." Now, if you could imagine what that means, right, in a system that depends on a kind of show of power to send people as a punishment to take care of a certain community, how is that going to, you know, shake out? And this, again, was another case in which, you know, there was a lot of questions about how Arthur McDuffie died. There was an uprising in Miami. And watching this video with these students who are not old enough to remember 1980, and to say, you know, Professor Chatelain, the ways that people are talking about it are like the ways that they talk about Baltimore, or the way they talk about Ferguson or Chicago. And to see that, you know, over the course of 37 years, the most sophisticated addition to the conversation is body cameras. It was really depressing. But I think that is why I think a product like Undisclosed is so powerful, again, to put all of this in a context so that no one thinks that this is about a generation that is bad, or a generation that doesn't respect police, or people are just out of control. They've gotten, you know, too big for their britches. That, in fact, we are living in a cycle, and a cycle that has been preserved by all of these systems. When I caught my first gun charge, hey, jugging, running crazy, we was going hard. Hey, me and B crept down on the boogin', but the gun jammed, so I couldn't complete the job.
There are a lot of people within policing who want to reform it. And that's been really interesting for me to see the walls that they run up against. Because, you know, I've talked to somebody that was, you know, well-liked and known in Baltimore, and he spoke about the importance of training police officers in the police academy on the history of race relations. You know, there are people with ideas about how it could change. And the general knowledge is that regardless of what you teach people in police academy, they're going to behave the way that their supervisors and their squad behaves. And their idea of what it is going to be based on what everyone around them is doing. So their idea, they want to be a hero, they want to do good, they want to be good people. It might be go out and arrest as many people as you can that day. And that might not have any impact on crime in the community. It might worsen it by creating bad relationships with the community. But the problem is that in terms of what it would take to actually reform policing, it's a huge obstacle. You have commissioners that are in and out of jobs. They're not there long enough to make a difference. There's the unions. There's so many barriers that people are talking about how to change it at one level, and then it just persists. People have been talking about how to change it for 20 years with really smart ideas, you know?
Yeah, and we have to put that bigger focus on the system, because even just to circle back to the whole conversation about people being excited and happy about body cameras is, you know, if you talk to Eric Gardner's family, you know, talk to the family of Walter Scott, these are caught on film, both in broad daylight, And that footage meant nothing.
Right. And well, yeah, and I think it's because it seems to be that the bar is set so low. And so what police have to do to be held accountable, I mean, obviously it depends on the city who's in charge. I mean, it's so much depends on who is making that kind of call. But consistently what you see is this sort of making excuses for it, like finding any sort of reason to say, oh, we're not going to charge because he didn't mean that or he was following the rules. And I mean, that's the case in the people who make excuses, and the defense's argument in the Freddie Gray case, you know, was largely about them following
even
the procedure.
Even every time we make a mistake and we, you know, when we call it, we refer to it as Freddie Gray's trial when Freddie Gray didn't get a trial. Yeah. So, you know, it's go ahead.
Sorry. Now I'm getting lathered. One last thing I'm going to say about this is that the fairy fields that are life and death for people in America are the fields in which discretion is a fundamental principle. So if we think about the recent problems that we've had with a travel ban that targeted a certain population, a lot of these things happen because it is a discretionary set of circumstances in which border control works, right? And it's the same way with policing. And so it's interesting that a public school teacher cannot drift too far from the curriculum. They will get talked to about it, right? But when we're dealing with people's lives, their mobility, their ability to access healthcare, and their families, we let people just kind of trust their gut. And that's the fundamental problem when that gut has been developed around ideas on racism and ethnocentrism and nationalism and sexism and misogyny, right? So it's this incredible way in which if you ever went to a doctor and they're like, I'm not sure how to do this surgery, but I'm going to trust my gut, we would say, what are you talking about, right? But in this place where I think so much of the work is about managing people of color and controlling them, it's like, go ahead and use your best instinct. And that is just so troubling. And it's so painful to see the way that it plays out.
Well, this might be of interest because it just got reported by the New York Times, to follow up on your point, Marcia, that the new Attorney General, United States, Jeff Sessions, apparently just indicated that the federal government, meaning the Department of Justice, would start to back away from monitoring troubled police departments.
Oh, I know. A student actually said that to me at the beginning of class. Like, did you hear this? And I was like, oh. And of course, so the Ferguson report, the Baltimore report, the Chicago report that came out of the, you know, Holder Lynch administrations, I think we will not see these types of reports for several years. Because it isn't just about what this attorney general makes a decision to do. It's about recalibrating the culture to believe that police violence is okay or normal. And undoing that work, like what it took to get, you know, Holder to take this seriously and do a set of things, we had to mirror the conditions of the late 1960s and early 70s when those types of reports came out. And, you know, the 1990s when those reports came out of Los Angeles. And so to see this happen at this moment is really heartbreaking.
Yeah. It's like it was not much progress was being made anyway. And then and now to have him back away, it's like, well, all right, back to square one or further back. And who knows what will happen, you know, once this administration is out.
Absolutely, positively what we expect from Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions just being Jeff Sessions, right? These things don't matter because they have no direct effect on his social context.
Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans proudly supports the Undisclosed podcast. Selecting a mortgage lender is a big decision, so it's important that when you make that decision, you go with someone you trust, someone who has your best interest in mind. And with Rocket Mortgage, you'll get a transparent online process that gives you the confidence to make an informed decision. You don't want to waste time that you probably don't have searching through stacks of paperwork. Rocket Mortgage modernizes that process. You can securely share your financial info to get a mortgage approval in minutes. You can even adjust the rate and length of your loan in real time to make sure you get the mortgage solution that's right for you. Whatever you're going to do, whether that's buying a new home or refinancing your existing mortgage, you can lift the burden of getting a home loan with Rocket Mortgage. You're going to skip the bank, you're going to skip the waiting, and you're going to do it completely online at quickenloans.com/undisclosed. Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans is an equal housing lender licensed in all 50 states, NMLSconsumerAccess.org, number 3030.
All I do want to go back to that piece about some of the projections and just a brief overview of everybody participating on the panel right now and the roles that each and everyone is playing in the construction of this podcast.
Sure. So I'll just sort of talk about what I have focused on. So Justine and I have largely shared the investigatory aspects of it. Because I live in New York and I'm closer to Baltimore, and I've been focused on really the investigating what happened, like what they say happened in terms of that actual day, you know, the van ride, the multiple stops. I've been trying to figure out how Freddie died, honestly. And then, you know, really, yeah, just mired in all the sort of certain evidence aspects of the case. I've been focused a lot on the autopsy report because the medical testimony at trial was pretty key to the state's case. So I've been looking a lot at that. And I've been looking at all the different stops and really sort of analyzing the narrative around those stops and like whether or not there is real evidence to support that. And if there are, what the contradictory narratives suggest, like from witnesses and stuff like that. And really just looking at the timing, because that was a big issue in this case. You know, the early on, it was the reveal that Freddie was arrested and the van stopped once. And then, you know, the van was only four blocks away from the Western District Station, where a half hour later, they finally called for a medic. And so the question was, like, what was happening during that 30 minutes? And there was a whole story that came out about that. So I've been really looking deeply into how accurate that story is.
So like Amelia and I worked together very, very closely on everything to do with the investigation of this case. She also, when she talks about being focused on the timeline and what actually happened, I mean, she's created second by second documents that are really thorough and kind of mind blowing and will cause listeners hopefully to question everything based on the videos and audio and eyewitness testimony. She sort of put it all together in a way that nobody has yet. And then I have focused a bit more on systems of accountability, the investigation by the police and the state's attorney, how they investigated the case, media, and policing. Baltimore policing has become kind of this passion project of mine, and speaking to officers as much as I can and understanding, you know, how this happens, because we can't call them monsters. It's not helpful. Even if people want to think it's true, it doesn't get us anywhere. And we also need police. I've been a victim. I've needed police at times. So it's a bit of a puzzle. And then I also got kind of into the knife and some evidence stuff. So the two of us kind of were able to complement each other in what we were interested in while also working together really closely on everything.
Yeah, it's been an interesting experience. It's been fun. It's been crazy. Like, I feel like I live inside of this case because I'm so obsessed with it and wanting to get things right. I feel very immersed in it. And it's a sad place to be, but you know, I feel like it's important and I really care about getting it right.
It's the work that's important. People deserve the truth.
My work on the podcast really is about trying to tell the big picture story of not only Baltimore, but of race relations in America. I'm a trained historian who just really enjoys opportunities to talk about history in different formats. So I was really excited when Robbie approached me about this project. And for me, in order to understand Baltimore 2015, you have to understand Maryland in 1642, you know, when slavery is brought to Maryland. And you have to understand the Civil War, and you have to understand the mass migration of blacks from the South into cities like Baltimore. And you have to understand the loss of industrial jobs and poor quality housing and lead poisoning. And so part of what I see this as is an opportunity to help bring more compassion by presenting more context of how we got here and why so many Americans live in fear of the state and live in fear of all of its actors who in many instances can do whatever they want to them. And so I really hope that listeners really see my content as helping them drive them towards more books and articles and poems and songs and whatever form that they need to really understand that there's always a bigger story and there's always a history that needs to be told.
I see my role in two ways. One is, first, I'm kind of the lawyer on the podcast right now. And, you know, there are so many legal issues to explore in the story, from Freddie's arrest and detention to police procedure to the charges the police faced to the trials, and just to understand kind of the legalities and how sometimes the laws themselves work against actually getting justice. And so, you know, part of my role is explaining and taking apart the legal issues attached to the case. And I also see myself kind of as the audience here in a way, and as somebody who is on the receiving end, listening and trying to understand as Amelia and Justine take apart the facts of what happened and how we misunderstood what happened or we were not told what happened, and reflecting that back as a narrator to them. And also, that's kind of been also my role in the last couple seasons of Undisclosed too, is to be kind of a little bit of a narrator helping the audience move along through the story, but also reflecting back what I think the audience might be thinking and questioning too.
And I trust that we'll all be joining in on the conversations on social media. So, you know, how can we follow everyone here?
I'm on Twitter at XOAmelia, so you can follow me there. I will look forward to tweeting about this case finally, because I haven't been able to. Yeah, and I'm happy to answer any questions people have, and or sort of, without giving things away, because, you know, there's a lot of information in this case, and we want people to be able to digest it and to be able to understand it and process it. So we don't want to give away too much too soon, but yeah.
XO Amelia, and?
Yeah, I'm at Jewstein3000, J-E-W-S-T-E-I-N. I took my name Justine and I made it as Jewish sounding as possible. Just so everyone is clear. And believe me, I get it from the anti-Semites, so.
As long as you're not a troll, you're welcome to follow me on social media at Dr. D-R-M-C-H-A-T-E-L-A-I-N, Dr. M. Chatlin. I'm always on Twitter, and I'm always happy to point you to more resources so you can learn more.
And I am on Twitter at Rabia Squared. Also on Facebook, you can just find me if you look for Rabia Chaudhry. It's a public profile. And I think I'm on Twitter at least 18 of the 24 hours a day. So
she is.
And I'm open to trolls, too. Sometimes they entertain me. So.
I'm at D. Watkins World, and you know, I want to thank the visiting panelists. And a reminder to fans who want to participate in the conversation, make sure you use the hashtag undisclosed or the hashtag Freddie Gray or both. Tag questions for future addendums with hashtag UD addendum. Follow Undisclosed on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram using the handle at undisclosedPOD. Thank you guys and have a great one.
The Undisclosed Addendum featuring D. Watkins was recorded at the Moose House Recording Studio in Baltimore. Big thanks to Ernesto and Ryan at Moose House for setting us up with a comfortable recording space just outside of Druid Hill Park. Hannah McCarthy and Rebecca Lavoie of Partners in Crime Media produced the addendum, along with super producer Methil Tellahan. Patrick Cortez composed that slick new theme you heard at the top of Undisclosed program. The in-bed track you're hearing is Timeless by FMG Dez, a Baltimore artist who was kind enough to lend his sound to our show. We want to make sure to thank our sponsors for this week's addendum, Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans, Audible, and Spike TV's airing of Time, the Khalif Browder story. Lastly and leastly, Undisclosed executive producer is Dennis Robinson, and he looks forward to Monday for Undisclosed, The Killing of Freddie Gray, Episode 2. Until then,